or finding out more about the this call to action, or other activities of the Council on American Islamic Relations in this area, how can they do that?
Well, the best thing is to go to our national website where they'll find the call to action and other information about the work that CARE does and Muslims do nationwide. And our website is care.com, and it's spelled in this way. It's www.cair.com, C-A-I-R.com. So that's our national website. It has the call to, it should have the call to action soon. And it has, again, other activities and the great work that CARE chapters nationwide are doing. And again, people can reach out to their local mosques very easily. If you go to IslamicFinder.org, IslamicFinder.org, you can search by zip code and find a local mosque and, you know, drop by on a Friday afternoon at 1:30 and say hi to people. Or most mosques have people have activities in the evenings. Muslims are out, you know, want to reach out to neighbors and get to know their neighbors. And we always welcome questions. I know there's a lot of legitimate questions out there. We always welcome questions from neighbors.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Arsalan Bukhari, who is the head of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Washington State. And we've been talking about the invitation that has been issued for Lieutenant General William Boykin to speak at a prayer breakfast in Clark County this Friday, despite his history of inflammatory and stereotypical remarks against Muslims. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kboo.fm. The time is 6:01. Stay tuned for Out Loud. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon, committed to helping 17,000 vulnerable people of all ages in our community live better lives each year. You can learn how to help by visiting the website at voaor.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Cross Cultural Rhythms at the 40th Avenue Garage, a showcase of music, dance, and spoken word performances, all sharing roots in African culture. Cross Cultural Rhythms will take place on Saturday, October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the 40th Avenue Garage, 1711 Southeast 40th Avenue in Portland. This is a benefit for the Obo Addy Legacy Project. Confirmed performances include Ghanaian drumming and dance, South African boot dance and music, multiple spoken word artists, and more. Again, that's Cross Cultural Rhythms, Saturday, October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the 40th Avenue Garage in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. Thank you to everyone who called in during our fall membership drive. With your amazing support, we reached our $80,000 goal. We would also like to thank all of our volunteers for doing a great job and for making KBOO a great community and radio station. And thank you to all of the restaurants that provided food. For more information on them, visit kboo.fm/food. We are proud to be your radio station and honored to have your support this fall membership drive. Thank you.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess of Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
Mm-hmm. Hey there, dear listeners. This is Alan, and you are listening to Out Loud here on KBOO.
KBOO's Out Loud. Welcome to our show tonight. We've got Boston in the control room. Thank you, Boston, for being here with us. And we have Buster Ross with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're going to be chatting with him. We're going to hear another piece of music here first before we get started. Why Thriller? Thriller, as some of you folks may know if you've been listening to the show for a while, I'm one of the folks who puts together Thrill the World Portland. We are the local branch of a worldwide simultaneous thriller dance. As goofy and nerdy as that sounds, it's been a big thing. This is our 8th year doing this. We're going to be dancing on October 25th in Northeast Portland. And we have lessons. You can come and hang out with us and learn the Thriller dance in full. Or you can look for instructional videos on YouTube and learn the entire thing at home. Either way is great. Why am I telling you about Thriller World? We do it as a fundraiser. We have done it as a fundraiser every year for SMRC, Portland's Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center. You can read up on their programming and how awesome they are at smyrc.org. It's a super honor to be able to help out with their finances because they just do amazing work for the queer youth in our city. So please, if you're interested at all, and you want to learn the dance, come out and do it with us. Or you can just come watch. We'll be at Irving Park up October 25th at 3 p.m. On Facebook, we are thrilltheworld.portland. You can also get in touch with me, ttwpdx@gmail.com. We also have a blog, but I rarely remember to update it. Afternoons, I'll get all the latest info about what we're doing on there. But we're super excited to be doing this. 10 minutes. So we'll be back in just a moment with Buster Ross. Great, Buster. Welcome to Out Loud.
Thank you.
How are you tonight?
I'm feeling pretty wonderful. I'm pretty grounded. I'm happy to be here. I've been looking forward to this time.
Wonderful. So tell us. Tell us who you are and how you got to be here.
Oh, well, that seems to be always evolving. but I'm a certified sexuality counselor, a drug and alcohol counselor, and a mental health therapist here in Oregon. So I run a program that's the first of its kind in our country for LGBTQ-identified people with drug and alcohol use disorders. And so I work for an organization called Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation, running a program here 40 minutes outside of Portland in an inpatient facility as well as an outpatient facility. It's about in Beaverton, about 20 minutes outside of town. So I do a lot. I have a lot of thoughts on a lot of things. But fundamentally, I think of myself kind of as a... I've just been following the thread of trying to help people with drug and alcohol issues, and it's been taking me deeper and deeper into kind of what it's about, into innovating approaches and kind of learning about this field I'm involved in and trying to improve the efficacy of treatment and outcomes in a field that has really struggled with that. So,
and this is a pretty pioneering work you're doing, creating...
A lot of people have been doing really wonderful work in trying to... get good treatment and support to gay, lesbian, bi, trans, queer, and questioning people. There's one program in Minnesota that's been doing it for like 3 decades. But really, what we're doing, it's different than anything that's happened anywhere else, and it's based on a kind of a different philosophy. So what I could describe the history in drug and alcohol treatment of LGBT treatment would be is kind of had to be more segregative. So to get good, culturally sensitive and sound treatment for drug and alcohol problems, queer people have had to go to facilities where there are only other queer-identified people. But in not all LGBT environments, treatment has been pretty subpar. And the bigger thing is, I don't know how familiar you are with Kinsey's work in the 50s, but there is a large segment of our population that has had same-sex and gender non-conforming, orientation non-conforming experiences of their life, sometimes coupled with chemical use, sometimes coupled with shifting experience of mental health and mental illness, and people who struggle to kind of make sense of those experiences. So the fact that heteronormative treatment, straightforward treatment, hasn't really addressed the issues has meant there have been a lot of people who have struggled to kind of find space and voice to make sense of things. I would say that, so there's something to be said for the experience of what chemicals offer in our culture. So rather than just thinking of addiction as a disease only biologically based and considering this kind of bigger setting, I mean, I would ask you this first. Like, what do you think chemicals serve for people in our culture right now? What use, whether it's stimulants or depressant or anxiety-reducing chemicals or entheogens or spiritually opening chemicals, what do they serve?
Well, I think it depends on, obviously it depends on what your motivations are in the moment. A lot of the substances we consume, whether they're labeled healthy or not, are really, they're about addressing some short-term need, whether it's, coffee in the morning or whether we go out of our way to eat salads, every day for lunch. And I think that there's sort of a whole range of complicated responses we have internally to the kinds of expectations we have for ourselves and that other people seem to have for us about what we put in our bodies.
I think there's something to be said that across cultures that chemicals can be are often used to facilitate or bring about some ritual within a culture related to community and exchange. And specifically though in the United States, what seems apparent to me is we have a culture of using drugs and alcohol to socialize with each other and to kind of relax and be at ease or to open up or to be inspired to do more connecting. And so at least my experience has been that people often at the in developmental process, say adolescence, when men and women, boys and girls, are separated, begin to kind of learn more about each other or have that period, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, chemicals represent this kind of conduit to set aside anxiety and to like experiencing sexual development. We don't really talk about sexual development happening before 18, but it generally seems to happen before 18, right, in people's lives. And that we have like this kind of hookup culture, this party culture, whether or not we're talking about gay and lesbian or heterosexual people. When people develop and discover sexuality in adulthood, it's usually mediated by chemicals for many people. So why I think, not to get too tangential, but why I think it's really relevant when talking about drug and alcohol treatment is that people have often learned about sex through using chemicals which alter their ability to consent, which may temporarily set aside shame, but that really people are not getting great sex education, not getting great skills to talk about and be embodied and be comfortable, and are using chemicals to make that more possible. And so it's really apparent that within drug and alcohol treatment, people who are getting there, it's almost impossible for their sexuality and relationships not to have been touched or impacted by their chemical use. And as an industry as a whole, it's not just been a kind of missing out on LGBT needs. It's been missing out on the sexual health needs of all clients, which is particularly apparent amongst the LGBT people who've been getting treatment. So I think one thing I would want to say is that research that kind of tries to look at rates of chemical use issues in communities suggests, some people say there's 2 to 3 times the rate of chemical use disorders amongst LGBT people when compared with the non-LGBTQ population. Some people say 3 to 4 times as high. And I think it's an interesting thing to talk about because there's something that, why would, I grapple often. What is that really about? You know, I don't know that gay and lesbian people are so prone, like on a biological basis, towards greater chemical use problems. What I think maybe as a parent, though, is that they're more susceptible, they are probably more likely to have experienced some family disruption, some cultural disruption. And also, if we look at gay and lesbian history, there's been a, to find safe space up until pretty recently, and even still, to communities built in bars and spaces around chemical use have been the places to do that work and find safety. So there's some cultural factors contributing to perhaps these higher rates of substance use disorders. But then there's also this, what we found, there's the research I recently got published in the Journal of Gay and Lesbian Social Services showed that when we looked at our patients, they were attending they had already been to 3 times as many detoxes and twice as many inpatient episodes by the time they got to treatment as our heterosexual clients or our cisgender heterosexual clients. And that's kind of was alarming to me.
What does that tell you?
One of two things. One, either gay and lesbian, bi, trans, queer people are trying harder to get sober. Or the other is that treatment is not reaching them in the same way it's reaching heterosexual and cis people. Now, I think both things could be true. But based on my experience within the field of drug and alcohol treatment, I think what's going on is that people have not been reached. People have been really suffering and struggling and have gotten to treatment seeking help, and they've had to spend the whole time translating what they're hearing because it's a hetero, sexist, kind of homophobic, unconscious narrative that is being presented in groups and lectures, and treatment doesn't really reach the core issues. And ultimately, what I think makes the greatest change for people when they're seeking help is the establishment of community and the reduction of shame, and the ability to access love and healing in the places people have really been blocked. And I don't think you can do that when you're not able to vulnerably really be yourself. And a lot of treatment environments aren't safe for gay and lesbian people, or haven't been. And the stories I hear about a lot are about even if it's not overt violence, just consistent experiences where people don't get it. They don't understand the experience, and they don't understand that what they're saying even completely dismisses the clients they're trying to help or understand. So.
Tell us a bit about what this treatment program at Hazelden looks like. How does it operate?
So we have a drug and alcohol treatment has been an evolving thing. So Hazelden is kind of notable as the oldest or the kind of real innovator of the 12-step facilitative Minnesota model, which is working from an interdisciplinary team. So it's medical providers, psychiatrists, psychologists, spiritual counselors, family therapists, like a whole multidisciplinary team, and addiction counselors. And Hazelden really grew out of this idea that alcoholism had been treated on lock wards, right, where it was basically kind of a hopeless condition for a long time. And in Minnesota, doctors had started bringing in people who were getting sober in 12-step recovery to these wards where they had been locked and nobody really recovered. And people who had a shared experience in overcoming problems with drugs and alcohol began to be able to reach people that traditionally like professionals couldn't reach. So the lay counselor was kind of born out of that, like the not super professionalized psychologist, psychiatrist, but a counselor with slightly less training but perhaps more personal experience. Hazelden grew this kind of residential model. You go away to like a rehabilitation center, you spend time, you learn about sobriety and this recovery process, and then reintegrate. But since then, we've seen an explosion, I think more recently, of outpatient clinics where people go and they might do 9 to 12 hours a week, like 3 nights, 4 nights a week, 3 days, 4 days a week of groups and individual therapy. So we operate, our LGBT program is both in our inpatient and outpatient settings. Essentially, though, people, I guess what is really important and what is really different about what we're doing in Oregon is that rather than – there's been – the belief has been in drug and alcohol treatment to give gay and lesbian people the best opportunity for recovery, that they've needed to be segregated. And what we've been doing is we've been meeting those same needs. I worked in an all-LGBT facility before I worked here in for Hazel and Betty Ford. And we've done a lot of work for years now to train staff, first and foremost. Not to train a couple counselors who get it, but to train everybody so that everyone gets it, to shift the culture entirely, like as a facility, to really be quick to it. And not that there's the person who deals with that issue, but we kind of all own this stuff and get it. And then after doing that, we've started expanding services. So we have groups, but really the focus is not just to separate gay and lesbian, bi, and trans people into a group, but to do interventions and planning that builds on the strengths of having gay and straight people together. Because often the issues that our clients are coming in with can relate to being really disconnected and not able to get beyond issues with straight people. I mean, there's opportunities afforded in an integrated kind of environment that you miss out on, I think, in a segregative environment. So in outpatient groups might look one way and inpatient another, but what's consistent is we give sex ed to all of our clients, whether or not they're gay or lesbian or straight. We give sexual health education that's really useful for supporting the recovery process. Because research has really suggested that getting good sex ed to people when they're in early recovery, in treatment, will improve their likelihood of being successful in reducing relapse and will actually help people be more successful at making it to the end of a treatment program. I firmly believe that sex issues or sex drug-linked risks are kind of have been like the leading cause of return to chemical use that people have struggled with, whether or not they're straight or queer. And so recognizing that those things are common, we've begun to kind of really deliver them to everybody in treatment. While at the same time, we do spend a fair amount of time building community amongst the LGBT specific people in our program. So we integrate really well and do work with Q Center in town, and I've put a lot of energy into kind of bridging and creating opportunities for people to find sober and like service oriented spaces to be connected to LGBTQ people.
What does success look like? For someone, in your perspective, what do you? Obviously, there's some really tangible measures of success, but I'm interested in a wider view on what successful treatment looks like.
Learning to see desire as sacred is the goal, is the outcome in the work that I do. So it's a loaded thing to say, and it's got many dimensions to it. But people often come sensing that something in them is broken on a deep level, and their base longing, their base desire, their base needs come from a place that's wrong. And so as people learn to kind of overcome or suppress the longing or craving for chemical use, at the same point, that kind of craving for drugs and alcohol that addicts can develop. Also, the feeling can be similar to a sense of a desire for union and connection that's really quite human. And so learning to separate out the things that might be more short-term beneficial to get our needs met to the kind of more long-term life-affirming stuff. My goal for hope for people not only to reduce harm, first and foremost, because recovery and transition from problems with drugs and alcohol is not so black and white. I mean, when I asked you about chemicals in our culture, you talked about coffee and salad first and foremost, which are not going to be like the measures of return to chemical use. Like life is a chemical experience, and it is on it. There is this element of gradient. But that said, like what I really want to see for people is generally the ability to make space for honoring what has not been met in their life, the ability to reduce shame around kind of some core stuff that people usually arrive to treatment with. We measure things like abstinence at 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, but we measure like quality of life measures too. My hope is that, I mean, so I can get pretty out there and pretty tangential about this, but I get calls and I talk to people before they come into treatment who are really struggling. They've been making efforts consistently to change behavior or they wake up and they drink throughout the day from when they wake up to when eventually they move to more progressive drinking and blackout drinking, and every day is kind of this impending doom and chaos. Or they go 45 days and they're good, and they use meth for 3 days straight, which is not what they intend when they start, and it gets tied up with sex behavior, and they by the end of 3 days is not in alignment with where they're wanting to be. And so what, regardless of what that looks like, there are consistently people call really in that space of that darkness. And my hope is to get them set up and connected and grounded to be able to really get their needs met in ways that are sustainable, and to not have like the struggle of fighting chemical use every day be the story of their daily life, and some, make room for something more.
Let's talk about the sacredness of desire.
Yeah. So if we look at history of homosexuality in our culture and kind of the treatment of homosexuality. So we're talking about treating gay and lesbian people for drug and alcohol problems. But if we talk about just our history, up until 31 years ago, it was completely reasonable to just be treating gay and lesbian people for their very identity, not for chemical use problems. That is our history. For the nature of their desire being defined by institutions as pathological, right? The doctor that invented, really brought the lobotomy into being, 40% of the people he gave lobotomies to were homosexuals, as he believed it was the only way to really cure homosexuality, right? Transorbital lobotomy, ice pick lobotomy. Like, mental health and medical institutions, the whole way we treated homosexuality in this reparative way, whether through lobotomy or through chemical castration or electroshock treatments. We finally stopped doing that, or we finally acknowledged the APA, the American Psychiatric and Psychological Association, moved out of that in 73 to 75 on a print basis. But the whole notion of repairing and treating homosexual desire has just largely translated over into a more underground or not psychiatric or psychological approaches, more kind of religious and spiritual side approaches and counseling approaches. And it wasn't until 1990, right, that the World Health Organization even kind of moved out of classifying homosexuality as a disorder or a disease. So I think a lot of times what I'm working with drug and alcohol and mental health problems is not that the person in front of me is broken and needs my help. It's that the person is still generationally recovering from this history that has been so vicious and so just from the space of fear, secrecy, and shame, that it's about making space to kind of just acknowledge that and hold that. And it's all, you know, today even it feels like any day now I could be out of a job, because our culture could actually stop. It could actually stop creating the issues that largely make this greater incidence of drug and alcohol and mental health problems amongst gay and lesbian people, which is the repressive approaches of social stigma and policing desire and seeing desire as based in evil or wretchedness versus in a sacred basis. And I mean, this week, right, one of our largest institutions in the world for upholding an idea that homosexuality is fundamentally sinful, beginning to change its tune. So I would be happy to be out of that job. Absolutely. So what if desire was sacred? What if we enter the space of sexuality through various entry points, but we don't enter it through a sense of brokenness, that it's almost an unconscious, deeper process. And where we get into trouble sometimes, or where we struggle, is once we're in that space of desire or awakened embodiedness, that how we act upon those desires in our world, our circumstances, and our culture, in some ways, it's almost on a continuum of, it can be life, like enriching and expansive, and in some ways it can be more tied, or it can have consequences. I mean, it really depends on who is judging it, right? Who in power says what is what about the nature of desire. But I think fundamentally, a lot of people struggle in believing that just the fact that they're experiencing desire is coming from something that's wrong, instead of acknowledging that desire is desire. It's experiential. It's not good or bad. It simply is. The actions we take and the meaning we ascribe to it culturally and individually is perhaps where we have expansion to do, or we can get more perspective. I'm trying to be very non-judgmental in how I say this, but yeah.
There was a, earlier this year, there was a a national conference in that was held in Clackamas County, which was the Hope Network's gay reparative therapy.
Mm-hmm.
We had Jason Ingram on the show. He was someone who had gone through that therapy in another part of the country, and part of his work here has been creating art that sparks dialogue about the horror and the violence of reparative therapy, and he was setting up to do a specific project very close to where this conference was held earlier this year. And it is indeed exceedingly painful that this exists, that it ever did, but that it continues to, that it's a possibility, that people can be forced into it as youth, that they can be shamed into it as adults.
I have yet to have a client in group. Right, so I do group therapy regularly with all LGBTQ-identified people. I also do sex ed for everybody in treatment, which is a whole other story and its own very great intrigue. But I do group, and I often hear the stories about where people's sexuality was first, or their nature or who they are was first kind of seen or glimpsed by the adult world in childhood. And also I hear the stories of when people first really openly disclosed being gay, lesbian, or anything other than heteronormative to family. And I have yet to really hear a story that has gone, when I told my parents, my family, this, that, and the other, I was met with the response of, well, that is a relief. I've been hoping you might share that with me, or that's one less thing I have to worry about. The disclosure traditionally in our culture around who we are as queer people has generally been met with, at best, understanding or acceptance. And maybe it's really changing, and it hasn't caught up with the clients I work with because they've grown up in times prior in our culture. But this idea that it's a liability, or even if people accept it, that I still am afraid for you because of the danger or the risk. And just to understand that for a moment, that regardless of how we feel about sexuality, regardless of how we feel about gay and lesbian issues or adult sexuality versus adolescent and youth sexuality, there are gay and lesbian children, or there are non-heteronormative children. There are tons of them. There were tons of them that are now adults, and there are lots of them today in Oregon without a space or a voice. There are lots of them today in the United States. I was just on Twitter, and there was all these tweets from the United States, like, drug policy Twitter, talking about how, like, it's prevention month. We want to do this live tweet talking about prevention for drugs and alcohol problems for our youth. And they were sharing tweets of people saying, like, maybe if we really addressed the issues that our youth are facing and supported them, drugs and alcohol wouldn't be such issues. And what strikes me so much is that this is what I really have been hoping to get heard, is that maybe if we didn't have reparative approaches and made space for gay and lesbian youth, bi, trans, queer youth in our culture, we wouldn't have this preponderance of massive levels of drug and alcohol and mental health conditions. It wasn't just finding higher incidences of treatment in the research that we conducted. It was also finding that our clients had three times as much sexual abuse histories reported, twice as much physical and emotional abuse histories reported. They had 50% higher rates of anxiety, 50% higher rates of depression diagnoses on top of chemical use disorders. But what strikes me is it's totally adaptive and it's totally reasonable to respond to growing up in a straight world as someone not straight and have a healthy sense of anxiety and fear if you watch the violence enacted upon people who don't fit in. It's totally reasonable to internalize negative attitudes and internalize anger when you're silenced in a culture and have that become a pattern of depression and self-destructive behavior. It's totally normative and healthy to have to use chemicals to silence a voice in you that's been programmed in to say that your sexuality is disgusting, it's sinful, it's the spawn of evil. To have to put that aside, regardless of how intuitive and empowered we all may be as, like, spirits embodied, growing up in a straight world as someone not straight is trauma. it's not that there's a high prevalence of trauma amongst my patients. It's that there's a collective wounding that has happened, and we're still working through it. We're still working through it, so it's still showing up. I am concerned that it's not even just that gay reparative therapy is hard to think about for young people. It's that it not only is unsuccessful at changing people's identity, it's highly effective at creating greater problems, greater suffering, greater mental illness, and propensity to chemical use disorders. So, which is great if your agenda is to harm young people and your agenda is to harm gay and lesbian people. But I don't sense that the people who are proponents even of reparative strategies really ultimately have that. I think it comes from a place of fear and a false belief that such things are really so malleable in young people. When attention and that kind of judgment and shame is put around sexuality, if anything, it reinforces and it gives a child great attention towards, and it, and it's probably even more likely to bring about the thing that's we're attempting to change anyway. So, I recently wrote a piece on the Q Center blog, which I write for generally every month. I wrote a piece for Go Local PDX, and I wrote about it on Q Center blog. And I got an email from someone who had passed it to some parents of a child who was a gay or lesbian child, and this gratitude of the relief it gave parents to recognize, like, the only thing really that they need to do is offer love and kindness. Like, there's not more. Like, there's no need to feel, what do we do with this, but make space and love and kindness. And so repairing something generally carries these heavier implications that aren't loving and kind, or that aren't acknowledging things as they are, as being whole in the way that they are. And I don't think it's called for in scripture as much as it's called for in evidence, science, or data either. I think creating space and loving kindness for children is it. I don't know what your personal experiences were as a child, but I would guess that you were not born into this world as a deviant and like sinful child bent on like, you know, causing harm. You were probably born as loving, kind, and a full-spirited child, like all the children I encounter. And somewhere along the lines, children come into contact with this narrative that this is really scary or this is bad, and wait a second, this is actually who I am. And often learn to protect that and to keep it underground. Learning to protect the secret, learning to protect the shame is so intertwined often with learning to protect and keep secret chemical use issues to the point that they can really get out of control. I want to make space just because I could continue to go and go and go. But.
Well, let's take a pause for a moment. We'll come back with Buster Ross. We'll hear a little bit from Douglas Dare. We'll be back in a moment.
I used to dream that we'd move somewhere, that one day would show. Stay in the blood.
All right. That was Douglas Dare. That cassette tape didn't seem to be cooperating so well. So we're back with Buster Ross.
The universe has other plans.
Indeed. How are you doing?
Good.
I was thinking earlier today, about how the kinds of psychic pain that I experience have a hard time staying in their you know, where they begin. They spread. They don't respect boundaries easily, and they travel through me and complicate things in ways that I'm not expecting. Mm-hmm. And it set off because I had a virus as a child, a young child, and I recovered from the illness, but the virus itself stayed in my nerves, in my nerve pathways. Mm-hmm. And so all of my adult life, occasionally I have pain in my nerves. Mm-hmm. And it's a pure pain. It's exactly what pain is, without any wound or any injury. And it's a really startling feeling, and it isn't uncomfortable because it has no... It's bounded. It doesn't mm-hmm. go anywhere else. It doesn't indicate that there's some fault in me that mm-hmm. I need to be working on. It just is what it is. Whereas that really isn't true for anything else that I struggle with.
Hmm. Immediately, I'm brought to thinking that, you know, what is so fascinating about pain, the body, sexuality, addiction, right? So we really believe, at least presently, that the pathways with which we experience physical pain are shared by the pathways with which we experience emotional pain. So something that anesthetizes emotional pain is also going to anesthetize physical pain, and vice versa. There is research where people who were suffering from like heartache from an ended relationship were given Tylenol, and it reduced their experience of pain. They measured it, and they said, well, wow, the suffering related was impacted. Now, this is obvious to me when we talk about people with opioid and heroin addictions, right? Oxycontin, the people who develop, that there's this overlap between the physical experience of pain and emotional pain, and that one can be felt for the other, and they can be interchangeable, and there can be these issues. And it's why it gets so complicated that people can become really stuck with like the development of chronic pain conditions as well as emotionally complex stuff going on. But what I've learned that I most like sharing with people about pain, right, is that we have an endogenous morphine system. We have an endorphin system, right, that can if I stub my toe walking out of here, it's only going to hurt so long because my own internal kind of morphine-like chemicals are going to release the pain for me. And we experience an endorphin pleasure release at all times of our life. You know, ice cream has queso morphine that acts on our endorphin receptors. So perhaps soothing to many. But I think part of that is why milk for babies is so powerful. It's the same kind of notion. But sex, working out, embodied stuff, whatever, are gonna also cause some of that endorphin release and that experience of pleasure and relief from pain. Now, what prevents one of the things that really prevents us from developing a tolerance or addiction to our own endorphins, not just that the body is navigating it, but that we think another neurohormone, this chemical oxytocin, plays a role not only in bonding and in loving relationships and attachment, but it also can be related to sensitizing our endorphin receptors or preventing a tolerance or the development of addiction. So touch and love and bonding and connection may actually not only be preventative factors for addiction, but they might be really helpful in helping people recover. So they did other research looked at rats, and they also looked at people in terms of oxytocin and alcohol and opioid withdrawal. And actually, like, love and touch can speed up the process of withdrawal from alcohol and opioid drugs and make it less painful and less anxiety-inducing. So if nothing else, I would just throw out there that as you experience both emotional and physical expressions of pain, that you put this in your back pocket, that touch and love may be really helpful at helping your system get more sensitized back in line to releasing some pain. I mean, most people are aware of the healing power of hugs, right? I'm not the first person to suggest this, but it's really why, for me, in our culture, looking at the kind of fear and disconnection we have from our bodies and around sex and love, that I think that those things are missing in recovery from drug and alcohol problems, and they're kind of guiding things that can intuitively help us secure a more lasting recovery from drugs and alcohol. I don't know if you're expecting any of that, but... You know, the other stuff in regards to just, I don't know. I think that our wounds and our psychic stuff are our greatest assets and gifts, because there are entry points to, with other people and our connections with other people. I don't know that a lot of what we do in terms of working with gay and lesbian people is so... complex as much as it is about really creating and fostering and supporting greater community connections. And the easier for that common identification, the greater the change. So really helping like anchor more sober LGBT spaces or opportunities, I think is a wonderful thing we've been able to do to give that ability for clients to have more to transition to. Because we also know that like service and acts of charity raise oxytocin levels, which can help. If we sensitize our endorphin systems, then we're going to feel the pleasures of life more. We're going to be more sensitive to the joys and the euphoric experiences of just living. So I'm really excited about this thing we've been doing at Q Center since April. Been doing a sexual health series, so the last Wednesday of every month we bring in different educators to talk on different topics of sexual health. And I've been trying to bridge these communities, bridge the drug and alcohol recovery communities, bridge the kind of like, there's this kind of sexuality and addiction communities, trying to kind of involve people who struggle with their sex behavior, as well as like therapists and counselors looking for education. People entering early recovery. So trying to bridge these seemingly maybe not connected communities, as well as just LGBTQ and sex positive community. So we recently brought in Charlie Glickman from San Francisco, who's an amazing sex educator who did a talk on sex, shame, and love. We brought Dr. Marty Klein, who I would say is one of the most fascinating minds, period, on things sexual, who talked about both sexual rights and freedoms for people in the United States, as well as just sexual intelligence and kind of like sexual function. We're bringing Janet Hardy on October 29th, who wrote the book The Ethical Slut with Dossie Easton. She also wrote the topping book, the bottoming book, Radical Ecstasy, like 11 books on alternative sexuality. She's coming and she's doing a morning talk on how to use writing and narrative to make meaning in sexuality. And then she's doing a writer's practicum, and then she's doing also a free talk in the night on non-property-based relationships, or like kind of ethical sluthood. So we make these events available, but we also make them free for people. And the only people who really pay for them are those who get CEs or training credits. And they're ASEC, they're sex therapist and educator credential trainings, which are really hard to come across in the first place. But we've been bringing these really radical minds and sexuality and these various intersections into our community and bringing it at Q Center since April. One after another, and I'm just really excited about Janet. We're actually like, we have like 10 seats left maybe for her talk at the end on Wednesday the 29th, which at Hazelden, hazelden.org/LGBTQ, we have a link to our sexual health series to RSVP for a free spot. But creating community spaces for sober people, creating these opportunities and connections, and I think it's a big part of what that's about. And also just trying to educate more providers in our community to understand sexuality more, to do better work. Because I guess this is it. In the addiction field, whenever we have talked about sexuality, we've just talked about it using the same lens we use to talk about addiction to drugs and alcohol, which is an abstinence-based kind of black and white approach. This is good. This is bad. This is triggering. This is dangerous. Shouldn't do this. Should do that. Instead of the kind of nuance of sexuality. So I think we're getting better at it through doing this talk about doing this education for our clients and our community about sexual health. I really do. And we continue to research the outcomes, both quality of life and sobriety, specifically to our LGBT services here in Oregon. And everything we measure is suggesting and trending towards that our outcomes are going to be far better than they are without the services. And they're better, probably going to be actually better than a lot of our heterosexual clients are experiencing. So we know as clients engage in treatment longer, they leave atypically at half of the rate that our non-heterosexual clients do, which when you leave drug and alcohol treatment, like against recommendation or at request, it's generally because you're struggling, right? You bail out of treatment and go drink and use and kind of run from what's happening. So,
And for you, that experience of success that folks are coming from developing in this treatment program is partly a result of community building and thinking about service to the community, sort of a give and take with a sense of being part of something larger.
I think that the success is that just being connected to people and having the space to talk and really explore the connections at this level and depth that we do is really helpful. But I think also that we bridge people into like Q Center and Portland Gay and Lesbian Community. We bridge them to volunteer and service opportunities. I think those things are all having effect. We also have we're in 11 states as an organization. We're the biggest nonprofit drug and alcohol treatment provider in the world. And we have our trauma integrated, kind of like our bigger trauma program is based here in Oregon. So I think we do something really smart between working with gay and lesbian population through this kind of empowered community approach while still having really trauma-informed provided care on campus. And I'm excited that the fact that we now have our services at Beaverton in our outpatient clinic, meaning that people are going to have this kind of slower step down where they can stay connected, stay supported in community, and transition over the longer term to really affect these changes.
One of the things you work with folks on is impulsivity.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like for folks?
What's the difference between impulsivity and spontaneity? It's what I always want to know. I've yet to get a good answer. I don't know. It depends on who's judging the behavior, right? But really, the ability to pause, the ability to wait to act on something, or even just develop awareness of the sense of urgency. I have to do this tonight, or it has to be this way, and just to be able to make some space. I think that that's really one of the critical skills. So most drug and alcohol treatment programs, ours included, right, will have a space for like yoga, meditative time. We have a beautiful 12-step walking trail we just finished construction on and fundraised this huge project. It's a really wonderful space. Our campus is pretty beautiful in Newburgh and kind of tranquil. And so a lot of it is just having the support to have things come up and sit on them and not have to act and kind of just surviving the day to work on that. But I would say this, I have a cute little chihuahua at home named Sophie. And Sophie came from a different home I don't know much about, but I know that she's kind of disruptive in our life in my home now. And Sophie, when Sophie is really acting intensely on instinct, and not behaving on the basis of what I think a dog should be behaving in my home, it's generally because Sophie has an unmet need or Sophie has some instinct in its way of needing it. So the punishing the dog doesn't seem to work so much as giving the dog time and attention and kind of checking out what it needs. So when we say someone's being impulsive, I would caution or question, like, what's actually going on? What does this person need that they're acting maybe seemingly rashly because there's a fear or a pattern of not getting it met? And how do we more proactively or preemptively support someone in getting their needs met so they can do it in ways that don't have long-term destructive consequences? One thing you make me think about, though, is that there's this idea in therapy or in helping professions to have these broad sweeping theories and magic bullets to fix things with people, or to have these like top 10 answers for this blog about how to deal this or explain that. And I think the biggest thing that we've lost in our culture and our world and healing modalities is the honor and respect for what each person brings. and how each person shows up with some deeper sense of what it is they're seeking and needing, and that we can let them, with some unconditional loving kindness and presence, let them guide the healing process. You know, if mental health, mental illness really became commercialized in a capitalist society, it would seem that the industry would grow and we would come up with new products. And we could even consider mental illness, different types of mental illness, new products and new marketplaces. So there's almost this trend in which when you merge capitalism with modern therapy, it can risk being exploitive. And then we can look for these therapeutic approaches for treating these expansive conditions when there maybe aren't like 500 mental health conditions so much as there could be more and more that are kind of overlapping or interrelated. Now, what I'm saying is not incredibly popular with some people, but I think there is a trend in mental health to see things on across continuums and to see that many things overlap. I mean, it's hard to say if someone has depression, anxiety, and they have bipolar disorder, and they're using methamphetamine, and they're using Valium, and they're using alcohol and heroin. Like, what is what? They become really more labels. So, if nothing else, I would want listeners to kind of hear that we really have pretty amazing supportive services for people with issues related to chronic pain, for like longstanding trauma and addiction, and for LGBTQ members looking for overcoming or kind of resolving issues around drugs and alcohol that are really outstanding and supportive. We don't address issues like sexual addiction. We address issues related to drug and alcohol addiction, and we look at the impacts and the overlapping things around sexuality. But we don't treat problems with sex as their own primary addiction or anything like that, which some people love to hear me say, and other people can't stand that I would say that, but it's just this notion that seeing desire is sacred, seeing sexuality is something that is kind of fundamentally wholesome, and that it can be impacted by drug and alcohol problems and mental health problems, but not necessarily because sexuality or love in themselves are fundamentally addictive.
If we were to create a culture that saw desire sacred, what do you think that would look like? I mean, obviously there's, there's no shortage of answers to that, but what do you think your answer is?
Well, I think it would start with myself and everyone else who's been later to the game of what's been happening, expressing gratitude to people like yourself, expressing, acknowledging grief for what's been taken or what's been done, what's happened, and also expressing gratitude for the persistent dedication to honoring the truth of identity, even in the face of violence and shame and cultural dismissal, all the forces. You know, I think it starts with us first amending what has already been broken. You know, before we can even talk about desire being sacred, we have to acknowledge what's happened and begin to kind of wake up to that. You know, what I'm really struck by being the son of a gay man and a straight woman is that I can't imagine the experience for my own father to have to choose. I can either honor who I am as a gay man, or I can and disrupt my family and break up my family, or I can try to keep it asleep in order to stay in this marriage and love my family. And so many people have had to face this fundamental struggle of, do I honor who I am or not? So I think it starts with acknowledging the gift of millions and millions of lives who have taken the risk to honor who they are. And I think the rest follows in terms of seeing desire as sacred. Seeing that that act of love and truth is sacred in and of itself, I think, is all that needs to start. That and the Catholic Church can keep doing what it's doing. It's a great start. It's really a great start, and others can follow. And we can make gay reparative therapy illegal altogether. And we can stop saying that sex and love are addictive, because they're just not. They're just not. There's better language to use that honors the sacred nature of sexuality and also brings awareness into the fact that violence, when merged with sexuality, can be quite destructive, but it's not because sexuality of itself is fundamentally dangerous.
Thank you so much, Buster.
Yeah, thank you.
Buster is LGBTQ program director at Hazelden. And the website for
Hazelden, hazelden.org/gay/LGBTQ.
And Ethical Slut.
Ethical Sluthood is on October 29th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Q Center. But also writing practicums and trainings for therapists are found in our sexual health series. And I blog regularly for Queer Voices on the Q Center blog. And you can find me there.
And you've been writing for Go Local PDX.
A little bit for them, yeah. A little bit for Q Blog, both. So.
Okay, thank you so much, Buster.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, appreciate you.
Mm-hmm. Next week, Carla will be here in this seat. Coming up next, Hard Knock Radio. This has been Out Loud.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis, and of course, as always, online at www.kboo.fm. The time is 7 o'clock. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor $15 Now, a community hearing on the City of Portland's fair wage policy. This hearing will happen Monday, October 20th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the SEIU Union Hall at 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. Portland's fair wage policy was adopted by the city in 1995 and is currently $10.38 an hour plus benefits. The community hearing will have testimony from workers, and Portland City Commissioners will be present and will be invited to respond to the workers' testimony. Again, that's $15 Now, a community hearing on the City of Portland's fair wage policy. Monday, October 20th, 7 p.m. at the SEIU Union Hall, 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.